And actually, I don't know that they make a reasonable case for that. Anyway, boy, am I going to be tempted to shut the door at 5 after. I wanted to try to close the loop on at least some of what I talked about this week, and it's sort of silly given the attendance, but let's go through it. Time permitting, I'm going to do two things. I want to do a quick walkthrough of the Kyoto's architecture as it stands today, which actually has changed a little bit from the ones that you guys knew. And I also, if time permits, want to talk about sort of what are the research opportunities in this space. So Kyoto's takes a very different view of the system than Unix does. Unix in some sense is designed to provide services for use by the programmers. Kyoto's view is that that's not the kernel's job, that if you want services, you should build them as applications and then you should invoke them, which is doesn't make it any harder to provide services, it's just a different approach. So where in Unix you talk about relatively high-level abstractions, I mean high-level, this is all relative, but like files, like mappings, like TCP IP streams, right? The Kyoto's kernel doesn't have any of those notions. Personally, in Unix, you don't have low-level notions like starting from the Unix API. You can really only talk about disk blocks indirectly. I mean, you can go to the raw device interface and you can seek and you can inquire what's the sector size on the device by going through device-specific calls, and then you can do writes of the appropriate length at the appropriate offset to manipulate a sector, but that's really kind of an indirect way of dealing with blocks. The unit that you're dealing with there, as far as the permission system is concerned, is the disk. So in Kyoto's, it works a little differently. In Kyoto's, there are basically three or four data structures at the bottom. And those are page, the GPT, the endpoint, and the process. So process is probably the one that corresponds most closely to Unix. A Unix single-threaded process looks a lot like a Kyoto's process, or maybe it's the other way around. But really, what is called a process in Kyoto's is a single thread. So the Kyoto's kernel doesn't have a notion of threads. If you want to set up multiple kernel scheduled threads that share an address space, you can do that. You do that by setting up two processes that share an address space. The process is, in some sense, closer to a thread than to a kernel process. Part of that is that in Kyoto's, well, we're going to draw a picture of what a Unix process looks like. It has really three parts. It's got thread state, it's got a descriptor table, and it's got an address space. And there's some other state in the process structure, like current working directory, but I'm going to ignore that for a minute. But that's the unit that's a process, and you can have multiple threads. So in later versions of Unix, you can see multiple thread states associated with the process. But the notion of a process and the notion of an address space are not separable in the Unix model. In Kyoto's, the situation is a little different. First off, there isn't any first-class notion of an address space in Kyoto's. Well, depending on your point of view, you might argue that a GPT serves that role, but it doesn't do it in the same way as the Unix model. And in Kyoto's, the way you associate the address space with the process is that the process holds a capability to address space. And I have to explain how address spaces are constructed to explain what that capability points to, and I'll do that. So if I want to have multi-threading, what I do is I simply set up two processes, both of which hold capabilities to the same address space. There's nothing directly like a file descriptor table in a Kyoto's process. A Kyoto's process instead has a capability register set. It's got a fixed number of them. So just like it has, you know, the Pentium case, it's got 8 data registers. It's also got 32 capability registers that can hold capabilities. Capabilities can also be stored in the address space, and I'll come to how. If I want to send a message to your process, I need something I can act on which speaks to your application as opposed to speaking to the process abstraction. If we're speaking to the process abstraction, the the kinds of operations we'd be talking about would be stop, run, get registers, set registers, change address space, things that go to the operating system's notion of what a process looks like. But when it comes time to implement services in the system, that's not the layer we want to talk about. It's certainly not the case if you're a server that you want every client authorized to tinker with your register set. So we need a notion that we can introduce some new capability type that's an extension of the system, where this extension is going to be implemented by an application code. In order to do that, we need a way to invoke a process. But what we really mean is by this is we need to invoke some behavior that's implemented by the application if that process is running. Okay. This is the extension point in the system. You'll see in the literature the term an extensible capability system. This is the extensible part. And the mechanism for that is we introduce something called an endpoint. The endpoint does hold a process capability to that process. Okay, so this is the server, or the service, really. Actually, it's most common for that process on the right to be some kind of a server or something. But it's not necessarily the case that this has to be a client-server relationship. So if I want to be a little more agnostic, I should use the term invoker and invokee. Let me finish describing what it is, and then let me take that question.
I just want to know if it's the way Coyote specifically is.
There are other possible signs. So in this case, what's going to happen is the invoker is going to hold something known as an entry capability. And these things that I'm drawing these little key symbols next to, I'm drawing those to make it clear that we're looking at a capability, not a plan. There are other ways you can do this. More typical than the endpoint solution is to have an entry capability that points directly to the target process. And that's how most systems seem to have done it. Well, the problem with that is that there's no way to revoke them individually. The unit of revocation tends to be an object. So if I handed out 100 entry capabilities to some service, and I want to revoke yours, I'd like not have to destroy the entire service to do that. And so in order to do that, what I really need to do is set up 100 different endpoints so that I can destroy the endpoint that you're holding a capability to. That allows me to do selective revocation. For example, when you close it, if this is a server that serves files, and you close a file, right, part of that is that your descriptor for that file should become invalid. And one way to implement that is to destroy the endpoint that your descriptor points to. So the way the kernel knows that the invocation you did is to be delivered to that receiving application is because you invoked an entry capability rather than a process capability. Process capability speaks to the kernel process abstraction. The entry capability speaks to the target application. These capabilities look a lot like file descriptors. If you think about what's inside a file descriptor, conceptually, there's basically a file ID and a set of permissions. This is not quite how Unix implements them. There's a lot more indirection going on, but this is sort of the core concept. You may have noticed that there's more than one type of descriptor in the Unix system. Like, there are also socket descriptors. So actually, it's a type field, and in Unix, that type is either file or socket. There's something that passes for an ID, and then there's something that passes for permissions. In Unix, the permissions are uniform, read, write, basically. Well, okay, so, but go back to the access matrix. An object name and a set of permissions held by a process, what we have is the capability. One of the tremendous ironies in the Unix system is that descriptors were introduced in order to improve performance. So there's this ACL layer that people claim all the performance rest. Well, there's an argument going back 40 years that the performance of capability systems is terrible. It's certainly true that some of them have. But if you look at how Unix actually operates, there's an ACL layer that you see at the file system boundary. But once you run the open call, what you hold is a descriptor. And that descriptor is a capability. And the reason that's done is because that capability points directly to the data structure that you need to manipulate. In the actual implementation, that's not just a file ID, it's a pointer to the vnode, right? The vnode has a pointer to what amounts to, in C++ terms, a vtable, an operation table, right? There's a read pointer, a write function performance. But what happens in the Kyoto system is the set of types changes. And the set of types is essentially these four things. Let me add two more. A cat page, and I haven't really explained how pages fit, so bear with me, is a page-sized unit of storage, but in contrast to a regular page which holds bytes of data, cat page holds capabilities. So there's a strong type separation in this system between data and capabilities. It's maintained all the way down to the storage layer. And then the one other type that exists, and it's not really, that list you could look at and you could say equally well, that's a list of capability types, or it's a list of object types. And you would expect that there would be close correspondence to these things, because for every kind of object in the system, you'd sort of expect that there would be some kind of capability that would know how to name it. Well, there's one, there are a couple of others, but the major one is this entry capability. And entry capability names an endpoint. And so if I'm talking to an endpoint through an endpoint capability, the kinds of operations I can do are things like change the process that the endpoint points to, destroy the endpoint, things like that. If I'm talking through an entry capability, I'm sending a message to the other application. Sort of the one place you can point to where there are two different types of capabilities that point to the same actual object. Okay, so that sort of got me through endpoint and entry. Let me give a GPT page and cabbage. So what about this dashed box I drew that kind of said address spaces? And for those of you who are fearful and sitting in the back, you have a hope in hell of seeing anything I put on the board. There is an endemic problem here at Hopkins. So address spaces in this system are not bundled with something like MN. Right? The basic operation for manipulating address spaces in Unix is MN. Arguably mprotect. But you can think about mprotect as an unmap followed by mmap with different permissions done as a single operation. The fundamental compositing operation is mmap. Maybe mmap. That's not how it works in Kyoto's. In Kyoto's, these are handled more explicitly. At the bottom of your address space, there are pages. And these are pages to which you hold a capability. You go and acquire one of these pages from a storage allocator. Those pages are organized by GPTs based on their position. Okay, so if I'm in slot 0 of the GPT, I'm in the lowest address range defined by that GPT. GPTs, in turn, are also organized by GPTs. And if this starts to look like a hierarchical page table system, that's not an accident. That's exactly what it is. It's a hierarchical page table system that's implemented in software. The GPTs are the page tables. They are, in the current implementation, 16 slots wide. So this hierarchy tends to be a little taller than the one that you may know about from the penny. Well, at least so it would appear at first glance. This leads up to what's the G in the GPT? G in the GPT stands for guard. And here's the idea. The observation is that when your hierarchical translation system starts to get very tall, what you will discover is that there are a lot of these boxes in the middle where really only one slot's being used. It's there to define a path where somewhere at the top you had four or five valid entries, and then at the bottom you had a bunch of valid entries, and in the middle you really just needed a path to get from the top to the bottom, and those data structures were otherwise wasted. So a guard is a field in the capability that lets us say, it's only legal to follow this capability if the address bits match the following pattern. That often allows us to drop GPTs in the middle. This is purely optimization, and it's a storage optimization, and it's a traversal time optimization. Not adding semantic power to the system. So if I want to define an address space, the way I go about it is I buy pages from a storage allocator, and I buy GPTs from a storage allocator, and I stick my capabilities in the appropriate slots to define an address space, in just the way I would in a hardware page table system, where the hardware page tables would happen to be 16 slots wide. I'm going to ignore guards for the rest of this discussion, because there's a bunch of implementation complexities that arise from that, but they don't fundamentally change it. Having done that, I have some GPT at the top of my hierarchical mapping structure. That GPT is the one that defines my address space, and the way I tell the process what its address space is I stick in a capability to that top GPT. Kernel will on demand traverse that structure in order to generate the appropriate mapping type for your hardware. If your hardware is hierarchical, the kernel will go and has a cache of page tables, of hardware page tables, and it will construct the mappings that correspond to what you defined here. If it's soft-loaded TLB, it'll do the same thing for the soft structure. If a hashed TLB, that algorithm is a little messy. We haven't got it implemented yet, but it's clear how to do it. And there's nothing real hard about that. It's a tree-to-tree correspondence, a pathwise, a lazily constructed pathwise correspondence. The only part of that that's a little tricky is that in addition to populating the hardware mapping structures, the kernel has to build side structures, because if you change the value of one of these slots, you're changing the definition of your mapping structure, and the kernel has to keep track of which things need to be invalidated when you do that. So it's got a dependency tracking mechanism that say, oh, if I change something over here, then over there in the hardware tables, there's a set of entries that have to be whacked. It does not attempt to do anything particularly clever when whacking those entries, because those entries can be rebuilt on demand, and it's pretty. So why this structure rather than MN? One of the things you want are a couple of answers. First, by making the mapping structure software defined, you neutralize a bunch of architecture issues. It doesn't matter which platform you're running on, the way you go about manipulating address spaces is the same. But second, and I think more important, there's a problem with MMAP that the MMAP interface doesn't tell me anything about how storage is going to be allocated by the kernel. And ultimately, I do a series of MMAPs, and the effect of those MMAPs is to describe a mapping, and that requires that the kernel manage a data structure that remembers what that mapping is. And there are a variety of implementations for remembering that, and in fact, if you look at the Linux kernel over the years, you'll see that it's used all of them trying to find the right one. And the reason is there isn't the right one. There's only a right one for a particular scale of problem. Unfortunately, there's no direct correlation between how many pages you have defined in your address space and how much storage is going to be required for metadata to describe that address space in an efficient, realistic implementation. And that creates a problem of accountability. It's also a problem with sharing, that if you and I share a mapping structure, that mapping is not going to get let go until the last of us lets go of it. And if I'm paying for the mapping structure, and you can stop it from being deallocated, that's a problem. And that means that you can basically hold my storage hostage. But what we chose to do in Kyotos and in its three predecessor systems is essentially have an explicitly allocated data structure that describes mappings. In fact, all data structures in Kyotos are explicitly allocated. And if you allocated it, you can destroy it. That means in particular, if you're the guy at the party who allocated a GPT from a storage allocator, which we call a space bank for historical reasons, and you hand me a capability to that object, you can go back and destroy the object, and my capability does not have the effect of keeping it alive. What happens when you do that is my capability becomes invalid. So there's actually another capability type to add to this list, which is the void capability. When an object is destroyed in the system, all of the outstanding capabilities to it magically become void. The system is clever in how it does this. It doesn't go running around hunting them down. It's got accounting mechanisms on the fly. It does guarantee that, as far as you can observe outside the kernel, that's what happened. Well, that's it. Oh, I left out CAPPage. So a CAPPage plays in the same role as a page. It gives me a place to store my capability registers to. And the reason we want to keep capabilities and data separated is if I could write data and then cause the data that I wrote to be interpreted as a capability by the kernel, then capabilities would be useless for protection because I could make up any capability that I want. That explains why we don't want to allow data writes to anything that could be interpreted as a capability. The argument for data reads is a little more subtle. I certainly couldn't make up new authority if I could read the representation of a capability. But there's a certain sense in which if I can read that representation, there's some encapsulation that's been violated. For example, there are cases where I may want to rebuild the internal structure of an address space. It's really none of your business how I choose to rebuild it on the fly. That's not something you should have any visibility into. Perhaps, in some cases, maybe you should. So if you could actually exhume the representation of the capability, then you could sort of watch a certain class of these changes happen. Because a general rule, don't allow capability state to be read either. There actually is a miscellaneous capability in the system that for historic reasons is called keybits, and it will give you the representation of a capability. There are very few services that have access to them. In fact, off the top of my head, there's an object that implements hash tables of capabilities. That object holds key bits, and off the top of my head, I don't think anything else does. Maybe a debugger, but even there, we're long. The only reason the hash table needs it is it's very hard to do any sort of efficient job indexing something that you can't examine. So you have no way to know if you're holding two that are the same thing. So you might look at this and say, well, so what happened to files? And there are two answers to that. First is, well, first, what's a file, right? And the file is an abstraction. It's a linearly indexed arrangement of bytes. In tricky file systems, that might have holes in it at the implementation level, right? Because long chunks of zeros are often not actually represented in storage, but that's an optimization. It's not hard to write a process and build a protocol that would implement read and write and open and close that would behave like a linearly indexed sequence of bytes. And we've got an address space mechanism which would account for where the data would be stored by that process. So from a behavioral standpoint, the way you would go about implementing process files in the system is you'd build a process that implements a file interface. And at this point, you're saying, wait a minute, that's completely upside down. In Unix, processes are built out of files. In Kyoto's, files are built out of processes. Okay, so what's wrong with this picture? And those of you who've heard about Kyoto's from previous years, stay out of it. What's missing in this picture? Give me a hand. What's missing in this picture?
Hold it up further.
In.
Yes.
Processes hold the state. What happens when the power is lost?
Just hold it.
That would certainly be true in Windows, but that's true in Windows anyway. Well, not only would you lose the file state, right, but anything that pointed to a process would tend to go out the window, you might think. So there are two answers to this. It depends on what kind of system you're trying to build. In embedded systems, it actually turns out that often you don't require any persistence at all. The majority of embedded systems want to fire up from ROM, and if you yank the plug on them, you want them to go back to the ROM state and just start over, because you want them to revert to a known state. And if they do any kind of saving of data, you know, they do it to flash RAM, and often isn't very much of it. Of course, this depends on the application. But there is a surprisingly large class of applications for which persistence is actually not desirable. And where it's needed, it's specialized. But for other applications, you need a story about how to keep this whole thing afloat when the power goes out. And the answer is, Kyoto's and Eros before it, Kikos before that, Gnosis before that, are transparently persistent systems. What that means is, periodically, there's a moment, an instantaneous pause in the execution of the system. The kernel goes through, and it turns off every write permission that's visible in the hardware state. Marks every object in memory copy on write. And it also marks every object in memory that is dirty. Logically, it marks every object, but objects that aren't dirty, there's no reason to write them down, so there's no reason to bother marking them. Marks every object that's dirty as being a member of the current snapshot. Having done that, it allows the system to proceed. And the earlier implementations actually work approximately as I just described. Later implementations actually do this by simply changing one word that says what the current snapshot value is. Then it allows the system to resume. And as the system resumes, it goes to run the next process, and it discovers that this process has been marked copy on write. So it hunts down a process-flavored slot in its memory cache, and it copies the process to this new slot. And in the new copy, actually in the copy, it says, ah, well now the copy is going to be the snapshot version. And having basically made this copy aside, I can now allow this process to be modified. Why am I saving the snapshot version? Because there's another exercise going on in the background. I don't want to overuse the word process here. Which is that the kernel is running through memory in the background, finding all of the objects that were marked snapshot and writing them down. So what happens is the system builds up a series of transactions and checkpoints. And that set of stuff that we mark snapshot, that's the content that's got to go to the disk in order to constitute a checkpoint. It's a transactional system. When all those objects have been written down, the system declares a transaction boundary, and you've got a solid copy of the entire stated system. When I say the entire stated system, I mean you've got pages, you've got GPTs, you've got endpoints, you've got processes, everything. So when the system restarts, the way in which it restarts is to go to one of the most recent of these checkpoints and reload whatever was running there and proceed. If you kick the plug out of the wall of the system and put it back in, it comes back with your windows and processes intact. Because those things are intact, things like file state that are stored in the memory of the processes are also intact. This is a total inversion of the arrangement that you're accustomed to in Unix. Now, catch with that story is...
So, what if something munches your file state or memory state? Are you an actual way to boot out?
Well, what do you mean by munches?
Something goes through and, I don't know, horrific astral radiation.
Okay, so you're talking about something that tampers with my, that causes a failure of integrity in my RAM. Okay, so the answer to your question is Coyotus runs a consistency check to make sure that the data structures are consistent before committing to a checkpoint. And if it discovers that they are not, it will immediately panic the system in order to reload from the
memory. I mean, if you lose your last notebook,
well, wait a minute. You talked about a RAM failure of integrity. Now we're talking about a disk failure of integrity. Let me do one at a time.
Okay.
So the RAM failure of integrity mechanism that we currently use is a CRC mechanism. I haven't actually been paying attention to it much in recent years. Historically, it caught about 4 particle hits on memory a year in software. And in some cases, it caught hits that were not caught by ECC. So it turns out that since we're only writing down the dirty state is often cached in multiple forms. We've actually got very good ability to correlate 2 different versions of the data to make sure that they're still credible with respect to each other. So it's pretty hard to sneak past this at the RAM layer. At the disk layer, yes, you could corrupt the store. And there are 2 answers to that. Which is, you know, some data really is critical, and it's worthwhile to write it down twice. And fortunately, it turns out that if you express that data as a percentage of total data in the system, it's actually not unreasonable. It's up to about 10 or 15% of your disk storage. So this is a system that was actually designed to be run on a multiplex, on a duplex store. In modern implementations, you probably wouldn't do full duplexing, but you would do selective duplexing. Or if you had RAID backing store, you might let the RAID system do it for you. And at today's price of disk, that's not the same. The problem with this checkpoint story is that sooner or later, I'm going to run out of disk space. And so what happens is that there's an initial checkpoint, which is handwritten to the disk that system install, which is the home locations. And after a checkpoint stabilizes, there's a migration process that basically copies the data back over the home location. So the checkpoint region holds a delta relative to the home location. If there are multiple live checkpoints, it's a sequence of deltas. The deltas get retired by overwriting the home locations. Realistically, the Unix file system structure is a lot more vulnerable to fatal disk corruption than this structure. Better experiments on that. Not so bad when you only lose 100 megabytes worth of stuff. When you lose your multi-terabyte backup file system, things get a little panicky. So that's how this system works. And it's a completely different structure than the Unix system, right? So there's nothing here in the kernel that does storage allocation. That's done by an application in this system. Nothing here that does files. That's done by an application. Nothing here that runs your Ethernet. That's done by an application. Now, those applications are, in some sense, privileged, right? They have access to hardware state. Some of them. But there's no requirement in the system architecture that forces them into the kernel. And that separation of concerns actually helps a lot in getting them debugged and stabilized. So the pattern of this system is you look for places where there's an interface boundary that would allow you to separate things into multiple processes, and then you do. And the reason is that you're trying to get reusable subsystems, and you're trying to get subsystems whose scope of function is small enough that you can actually hope to test them. So I've conflated 2 things here. One is a microkernel design. And there are other microkernel designs that don't use things like GPTs. L4 is an example of one that actually has a mapping-like structure. And the other is capabilities. So in this system, from the kernel perspective, there are no user identities. If you're a process and you hold a capability, that is a necessary and sufficient condition you to make whatever calls are permitted by that capability on the object that the capability makes. That's where all the protection in the system sits. And you might think that sounds pretty weak, but it turns out that this system in particular is the only system that we've got a formal model for that shows that we can actually do a property called confinement. That is, that we can ensure that writes do not leak. And we don't know of any other class of systems that can actually, that have been formally demonstrated to be able to do that. Question actually was going on the Lambda the Ultimate site last night. Somebody observed that there are lots of policies that people want that can't actually be expressed in the protection system of your actual operating system. Our term for those is wishful thinking. They're not enforceable. Often have to do with social objectives that people are trying to meet that may be perfectly fine social, well, they often turn out to be senseless social objectives, but you know, they're at least not on the face of them usually wholly absurd. They just turn out to be things that computers have nothing to do with. I'll take questions on this before I switch gears. Oh, and let me point you at a couple of places to look at. The L4 system, www.l4ka.org, I think it is. The Kyoto system, kyotos.org, or for its predecessor, which may be a little easier to understand, arrows-ls.org. Questions on this? Kind of a weird way to think about systems. Not that we removed any function, right? It's that we structured it in a different way. Let's switch gears. Consider a system like Plan 9, where they took this client server idea in a slightly different direction. So in Eris and Kyotos, you describe an interface sort of in the style of a remote procedure call interface. So every service exports some interface that contains methods, and there's some support software that will basically create messages and send them back and forth. So from a C programmer's perspective, these things look like procedure calls. Plan 9 went a different way. They said, well, we're going to fix the protocol. The protocol is always open, close, read, write in the style of Unix. But we're going to introduce a second protocol that deals with mount points. And the way we're going to deal with services is we're going to let a service publish itself in such a way that you can mount it in your namespace. And it can publish what appears to be a directory tree. So in Unix, really the only thing that does this is the NFS server. But there's no inherent reason why other things shouldn't do it if the protocol were there to make it straightforward. So in the Plan 9 view, anything can publish a portion of a file system, and then you can execute opens on the names that that object publishes, and having executed opens, you do reads and writes. And they chose to fix the protocol. And one of the reasons they chose to fix the protocol is reads and writes have the nice property that they're fairly generic, and so it's fairly easy to remote this stuff without having to know anything about the protocol. It turns out that this completely screws up their permission system. You'd like to imagine that if you don't want me to modify the state of an object, all you have to do is turn off write permission. Fortunately, it's not true. If you think about what happens in the read call, what happens is my client writes a message to your server telling it what I want to read, and your server responds with something. So that read call is actually a bidirectional operation, the first half of which is actually a write. I want to stop my client from transmitting data to your server. Disabling write permission isn't enough because the read call, I can encode things over it. The reason that read and write permissions work in a system like Unix is that all of the servers are trusted code. So yes, even in Unix, if I do a read call to an NFS server, there is a protocol there, right? But we're trusting that the NFS server is not going to collude with me. And this is sort of an example of a bigger problem, which is that if you have a descriptor that is a reflective descriptor, right, where I'm going to have a message come in and the message is going to go back out to some process, and you know, I don't really know what that process is doing. There's a problem here that because I don't know what that process is doing on the kernel, I don't know how to enforce protections in that process. And I don't know what the calls mean. I don't know what things to turn off. Question? Yes, it can. This problem is fundamental. The only way you can solve that problem is by trusting the file server or not as a whole. The point is, because you don't have it, so let me finish the story. The point is, because you don't actually have any insight into what the protocol means, how the protocol is going to be implemented. If you're forced to downgrade permissions, you have to be pretty draconian about it. You can't just say no more writes, because that doesn't actually mean anything. The best you can really do is say no more messages, not even reads. And so there's a very sort of black and white effect that is the price of this kind of reflection. Or you have to declare that the recipient, even though it's an application, is inside the trusted computing base, and therefore you do know something about its behavior. So there's this problem, essentially, that behavior becomes very opaque across this boundary. And there's really no way in current systems to reason across this kind of boundary. So if you look at the way people analyze protection in systems, what they do is to say, okay, I have a short list of applications that are trusted. Let me just set those aside for a minute. Then I'm going to build a model of the system, and that model is going to include both the generic mechanism for sending messages, and include all the processes I don't trust, and then instead of including the processes that I trust, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the behavior of those processes and I'm going to build it into the model, and then I'm going to pretend that those processes don't exist. And then I'm going to ask whether the resulting model of the system, whether I can say anything useful about its safety or security properties. This is sort of the usual method. There are two problems with this. One is, this kind of simplifying modeling is very, very prone to error. It's just not very credible, because what you really did here was you took one system, right, and you re-architected it into a different system, and then you simplified it, and then you did properties on that, and maybe you got somewhere, and maybe you didn't. But at best, those properties are about a system that has a tenuous relationship to the system you're actually running. Another problem, though, which is that if you think about what happens in an ACL system, the reason I'm allowed to make a call, right, is not because I hold a descriptor. It's because I hold an identity. And also, typically, because I hold a descriptor. But in particular, things like open are principle-based, not subject-based. And at the point of the call where I call open, if there's nothing I pass that says, and here's the principle ID I want to use. And because of that, there's no semantic descriptive mechanism we can use. It gives us a unifying story of how to model the kernel's view of the system and how to simultaneously model the behavior of those applications we would like to trust. So we can't build a coherent model of the system as a whole, because we don't have a common frame of reference for those two pieces of the system. That is the problem statement. I want to take my remaining 2 minutes. I want to do a little bit of a rearrangement of capabilities. So I said that a capability is a type, an ID, and permissions, which is really a shorthand for a set of operations that I'm going to be doing. I'm going to ask you to allow me to wave my hands for a minute, and I'm going to dodge the bullet on the type system, because the story I'm going to tell right now doesn't quite work in the type system. That can be fixed, but I want to get the concept down. Of course, you can't see the ID or the type. Those are opaque. So one way to think about this, suppose we imagine that these operations are names, identifiers. I'm going to fix this in a second. Really want is the C++ vtable notion, but we don't quite have the notation. Maybe we do. Yes, we do. I'll take it back. All right. So one way to think about this construct is it is an environment containing bindings of the form, right? In an environment, the thing on the left is the name. Right? It's an identifier. I mean the environment here in the programming sense. The thing on the left is the operation. What that operation is bound to is something of the form lambda args on the implementation. So that's what it looks like from the outside. But how did that lambda thing get built? Well, what really happened was we had a let. I apologize for the lisp notation, but at least to readers, it tends to be somewhat self-documenting, right? Where we fabricated the object we wanted. Right? And we bury this ID identifier, right? That's going to be the reference to the object. And inside that, we had a first-class procedure which implemented some function. And bear with me a minute and imagine that there's only one operation. So this thing that looks like a procedure from the outside is actually a closure. Closed over the type and the ID of the capability. So you can think of this view of a capability as being completely interchangeable with the view in which a capability is a reference to a closure. Or you can see that intuition, how that might work. I'm going to have to tell a story about how to get more operations out. So it's going to turn out in the end that a capability is actually going to be a reference to an environment of bindings from operation names to their closures. But it's also going to turn out that all of those closures are going to be bound over the same ID and type for a given capability. Ignoring the issue of multiple operations, do you sort of get the idea that I might be able to go from this representation to the closure representation without losing, without really any change in what's going on? Ways of representing the same thing. This is kind of cool. Yeah. This means, by the story, and it's not quite right, okay? I've skipped several steps that are necessary to actually make the story come out right, but they're doable. In fact, they're straightforward. By the story, then something interesting just happened, right? We can now describe the kernel as a subsystem whose interface is defined by this set of closures that it exports. And we can also define the behavior of application level services as things that export to you a closure that you can call. This is really cool because for the first time, for the first time we have the ability to speak about what's going on computationally across the user kernel layer using the same terminology for the application code and the same logic and the same reasoning style for the application code that we used for the kernel code. All of a sudden, if I have a trusted process whose behavior I want to reason about in the system, and I'm willing to tell you what the code of the trusted process is, we can now ask, there's a set of closures that are published by the kernel, right? And there's a program over here that the trusted process runs that manipulates those closures in well-defined ways. And now I can reason systemically about what happens overall as all of these things operate together. So what this says is, as long as I'm willing to reveal the source code of the trusted systems, I can reason across the user-supervisor boundary. And that actually lets me talk about the system behavior and correctness and consistency and security as a whole without doing that modeling reduction that was debatable. And if you can't do this, there's a problem that every time you alter the system, you've got to recheck that model. And that model simplification was done by a human being. And it's error-prone at best. It rests on a story about the system. It doesn't rest on the system itself. And so the cost of validating it is very high. And every time you update the system and change it, you have to revalidate. Just to calibrate that, the last time an A1 trusted system certification was done, it ran about $7 or $8 million. Okay, and that was for a network router, right? It was a fixed function device. Every time you update the code on that, it's basically the same price again because you really can't reuse the result of the previous evaluation because none of it's automated. And the reason none of it's automated fundamentally is that it's really, really hard. But one of the reasons it's really, really hard, in fact, one of the reasons it's been unreachable, is that you could not reason across this boundary to talk about trusted code in an automated way. The thing that I think from a research perspective is really cool about capability systems is for the first time we have a consistent end-to-end way to talk about security properties in systems. And there's no other class of system out there for which anybody can even begin to say that. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this week. And let me get out of here and let the next class in.